Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. BellaCatering.com.au is where you can find Sydney's best catering company. And now they're doing home delivery. Check out what they've got. Get to it fast, Sydney. Victoria has already shut down, which is good. They're acting like idiots down in Victoria, but we are no less idiots here in New South Wales. So, my dear friends and listeners and folks, you, of course, have come across folks who are not doing the right thing with COVID-19. You need to contact Bella Catering while you can. Get the people to your house now that you want to visit. Check their temperature before they get in the door. Make sure that they're hand sanitized. Feed them with some delicious Bella Catering food. BellaCatering.com.au. They are responsible for the show this week. We must thank them. We must love Glenn and Maria and thank their team and everything they do. Now, let's get on to the show.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave, or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. The 70th episode of this crazy undertaking, and we are steaming into in heat. It was the coffee shop scene or the explosive LA bank heist in Last of the Mohicans. We focused
on the climactic moments of that movie. In Inkermit Vice, I don't know what the pièce de résistance is there. You'd have to suss out with Travis Woods, a Heart of Gold on Twitter, to see what he feels. I think I've got my own. I think that the movie crests in many moments of that film. But we're heading into the bookkeeper scene, which I think is one of the pièce de résistance scenes of this entire picture. And what is so important to the lead up and the payoff of that central scene is every slam door in the face, every thought that they're encroaching to getting to this story closer. And I'm so excited because right now this is like literally a red-headed herring moment in this story. And I have someone drastically overqualified to talk about it. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome a national political correspondent for Reuters who has covered the White House, Congress, Supreme Court, and continues to cover the absolute chaos of the coronavirus pandemic in the United States. I'm so glad to see that he is alive and well and healthy. James Oliphant, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes.
Well, it's great to be here, Blake. Thanks very much for that lovely introduction. You made me sound impressive, which I always appreciate.
Well, at the very least, to thank you for your time. I can say that you're impressive. It's a crazy time. This is a movie that at the beginning of this project, I thought, wow, wouldn't this be really great to do now as the next cab off the rank of this Minute by Minute podcast, to just chart how similar the time feels between, you know, some of our political sort of political and journalistic and historical turmoil that we're feeling. And this is more of like an abstraction. And now, as we're heading into, you know, July and nearly August of 2020, it feels like it's ancient history. It feels like it's another world, another universe, maybe even another country that this film is set in. What is it like right now for you being on the front lines of journalism covering politics in America?
Well, I think the hardest thing about it, Blake, is that we're really not on the front lines right now because so much of us are forced to work from home, and we're not, this is the fourth presidential election in which I've been involved. And, you know, of course, it's not like any of the other ones. Even if Donald Trump was not involved, it wouldn't be like any of the other ones because, I mean, there aren't the campaign rallies. There aren't the, we're not riding buses and jumping on airplanes and we're not seeing, you know, I've seen Joe Biden a grand total of one time in the last 3 months. And that is just not the norm for this business. And so a lot of it's on the phone, and a lot of it, and I would add to that, it's much harder to talk to voters. It's much harder to talk to regular people.
Yes.
And so in the run up to the Democratic presidential, to Biden winning the nomination, you know, we were able to go to Iowa and New Hampshire and all the early voting states and, you know, figure out what people cared about, you know, what they were thinking about. And now that's just so much harder. It's harder to reach random people, you know, virtually. It's just the people who tend to stick out online are the people you probably don't want to talk to.
Yeah, much easier to sort of passively sidle up to someone who's sort of quietly going about their business to sort of get the not loud person opinion.
But yeah, the person is not a professional opinion giver, if you know what I mean. Like somebody who actually might have some thoughts and be thoughtful, but also is not, like I said, somebody who lives and dies and breathes and watches Fox or MSNBC every night and tweets and posts. And because you pretty much know where those people stand.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy from that point of view. They're usually wearing the MSNBC or Fox News t-shirt at that point, or a red hat with white writing on it that's become so synonymous. I've even seen some MAGA hats in Australia.
Really?
Yes. And it's just like, what are you doing? Is my first question.
Well, it goes to sort of my, you know, my unified theory of Trump, though, which is, you know, for us in the political press, we've driven ourselves crazy for 5 years trying to sort of explain him. But you know, he's more than anything, he's sort of just a cultural touchstone. And for better or for worse, where people, they feel like he lines up with their view of the world, and other people are repulsed by that. And then all the other stuff, you throw the policies and you throw the behavior and you throw the tweeting and into the mix. But ultimately, it strikes me more than anything is that he is basically just the front in the culture war. And so by wearing a red hat, you're declaring which side you're on.
Yes.
Wherever you live.
Yeah. And what's strange is, if you can try and even be remotely objective about it, at the beginning of his campaigning, so the things that made serious people take him seriously, some of the things he was campaigning his platform, not just the wall, but like other things, regulations of like, for example, Wall Street, like banking regulatory, like things and things like that. Some of those big financial elements that actually got some significant power players on his side. You look at some of those things that he said that were the most objective and the most like really like diplomatic and actually had a political agenda behind them. And it just all seems like once he got in the office, it feels like he thought that it was a big joke and that he was never going to make it in there. And when he arrived in there, it's like, now I have to actually do this. And it just feels like every single day there's a new stunt. And in this year that feels like it's 10 years long, 2020, in this year that it feels like it's 10 years long, it feels like crazy. I think there was a meme the other day on the internet, and we can say this because these episodes get posted so frequently. You know, you guys are going to be listening to this probably a few days, maybe just under a week after we talk, James and I. But I just saw a bunch of people take photos of their beards. A lot of guys and gals like taking photos of their sort of sideburns and going, this was my hair in 2019 and this is my hair in 2020. And everyone has got the Obama first term versus Obama second term, but it's happened in like 6 months of 2020.
Yeah. Well, and I think what's interesting about what we're seeing right now, like, is, you know, for years we have sort of said that, you know, Trump's his, as he would call him, his ratings, or, you know, what we call his approval, has always been very stable. And with the Mueller investigation, with impeachment, with the whatever controversy of the week, you know, Charlottesville, whatever you want to pick, he always sort of hovered in around the same range. It was almost like, you know, he was locked in, and it's not that he went higher either. He just sort of stayed in the same area. And I think now, though, with the COVID, with the government's handling of the pandemic in the U.S., you are seeing some erosion now. I'm with people who were more inclined to maybe give him a chance and maybe give him a second term. Well, obviously, we don't know what's going to happen. There's more than 3 months to go, but now, this is a time where you can feel a sense among the American public. They don't have any patience for the sideshows right now. And we're in a crisis. They want to see the president manage a crisis. And all the polling that we do tells us that right now he's falling short.
It's funny that you say that. I've heard it put in other ways. It's like people want to not care who the president is in the country right now. They just want to be... they want to be pleasantly bored that there's an older person in there just getting on with it and not caring. And in Australia, just as like to have a little like a strange mirror, is for many years, it started with our first female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard. There was a spill election, which basically means, for international listeners who aren't listening, who aren't familiar rather, a spill election means that within the political party in Australia, their own party can vote out who is actually the prime minister, because the party is elected. And at the time, Kevin Rudd was our prime minister. He was voted in. He was extremely popular, came in after a very, you know, our most enduring prime minister was in there, who was a conservative. He comes in, he's more of a liberal. The Liberal Party is our conservative party in Australia. So go figure, he's a Labor representative. Anyway, his party usurped him as the leader of the party, and he comes in. And that sort of triggered like years of political uncertainty in Australia on both sides of politics, where you would vote in someone and then they'd get usurped by their party because they'd lose the faith of the base, because broadly a lot of Australian politics like functions on this like weird centrist, sometimes right-leaning thing. And so if you're not making the right people happy, your party can usurp you. And so our current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, came in on a spill motion where he was like the underdog in the spill and won it. And then so for like a few months in Australia, like people were like, who's our Prime Minister? And also who cares? And I feel like that sentiment is what a lot of people want to go back to in a lot of respects, because it's like if you've constantly got a sideshow and every day is a new tweet and every day is a new news cycle of nonsense or like some maddening thing, it's just like, I mean, and at this point, I can only empathize, but at this point, someone like yourself who has been doing serious journalism about a serious journalistic topic being politics for some time, the outlandish levels of dialogue that you have to even entertain as part of your job at the moment and wade through to get to what the policy is and how it actually impacts the American people must just be like such a slog.
Well, you know, and I'm sure we're going to get into this with the movie. But, you know, the American media is not without some culpability in all of this. And, you know, in terms of favoring spectacle and outrage over facts and policy. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you're describing is something that, you know, we often refer to as Trump fatigue.
Yes.
And, you know, is it just, okay, you know, on the screens all day long, on social media? Yeah, and we were always wondering, is there going to be a point where, you know, that America collectively just is like, okay, yeah, we'll take... You know, we're exhausted.
Yes.
And so, like I said, we don't know what's going to happen, but you know, it just, there is just sort of this feeling maybe that maybe we've reached that point where, you know, the country would just like to calm down a little bit and, de-escalate. Not everything has to be trench warfare all the time. And not everything has to be outlandish and outrageous. And I mean, one of Trump's great skills in 2016 and getting elected was tapping into that culture.
Yes.
You know, a culture of being aggrieved and being outraged. And he understood the new cycle and how to win it and how to, you know, and, you know, as people used to complain, you know, his rallies were like, you know, they were aired publicly on CNN and other networks. And it was a spectacle. It was a show, and he gave people a show. And he knew what he was doing. And the thing is, I mean, that's his, he's still trying to do that now, but it's 4 years later.
It's not the
and
time.
It's just not, you know.
It's like a comedian.
The sequel is never as good as the original. For Godfather 2 and, you know, the second Superman. I don't know.
I was just going to say the major thing is, comedians talk about it all the time. Like, you have an act and you have an hour. And when you're a showman, ultimately that's what you're doing. Like, you have an act. And a lot of contemporary comedians and the, you know, some of the greats, the Pryors and the Carlins and the Chappelles of the modern age, like, you do your hour, you do your act, you tour it around the country, and then you have to jettison it to create a new hour.
Right.
And it feels so... Like, I feel like in 2016, paired with the outrage as a spectacle, and now it is just so tiresome and it's complete. It's like misfire after misfire. It's like, we get the shtick, man. It's done. Like, we're so done with this shtick. We don't need it anymore. And so then we hurry back, like I'm making you do today. We hurry back to 1976 and to this movie, All the President's Men, and we go back and look at a time when a president had shame. Something that,
the shame came late.
Yeah.
And I just, for the record, I want to say I was alive, but I was not in journalism in 1976.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't alive at the time, but also the hangover of this, you know, seems to impact. I think it's like that in the 80s post Vietnam, there was like that fake, I feel like it was like a fake haze, like after World War II, that peace and prosperity internationally and the rebuilding of society and like people just being so, you know, tired of war and tired of death and tired of that sort of plague that had affected Europe and then spread its tendrils throughout the world. You know, that peace and prosperity is like a genuine, but I think in the '80s, that's like the Reagan fakery of it all. It's like, oh, the war's over and we're good and it's time for prosperity. But there's still a lot of the undercurrent of issues that sort of simmered away there and then didn't take as long to rear their head again. But I feel like that's, you know, going back to 1976 and having a look at this and like facts and policy and journalism on the ground and looking at, you know, being able to have a moral dialogue with people on both sides of the aisle is like a holiday compared to what you're wading through every day, I imagine, on Twitter and just seeing manifest all around the world at the moment.
Well, Watergate does feel like one of, and maybe the last, or one of the few, you could maybe put the Iraq War in there, where there was a bipartisan, ultimately there was a bipartisan sense of outrage at the president's behavior.
Yes.
Where, you know, a feeling that Nixon was acting in contravention of the nation's morality and its values. And yes, it took the Republicans longer to come around. But they did, and that's why he resigned. And you know, it was the sense that there was a common set of values. There was something. There was a standard to uphold.
Yes.
And it wasn't a standard that to be applied on a partisan basis. And of course, there's been partisanship through this country since its founding. But it was a matter of the legislative branch of government rising up and saying enough. With this president and reining him in and holding him accountable. And the media was a big partner in that, obviously.
Yes.
And it was a media, you know, that was much smaller, much more concentrated. And, you know, it was a much different time where the media was much more influential.
Yes.
Than it is now.
Well, I'm going to put you into the chair, the boots of these guys, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. And we're going to dive into a scene where on the grind, going through phone books, looking up addresses, trying to find people, they feel like for the first time they're being welcomed into someone's home. Obviously, spoilers for those people who are 70 minutes into all the president's minutes listening, you know that that's not the case. But it's a nice little red herring reprieve moment for the film. And I think it's important because sometimes, I really love this scene because it just feels like a false platitude. It feels like articulating the false platitude that sometimes things happen. And it's just nice to go, oh, well, there's a nice little false platitude that means nothing. Ultimately, thank you very much. But it's good to see, at least for them, they're going up to someone who maybe doesn't have an opinion, who is reading and consuming everything. And it's actually a really interesting dialogue with the audience as well. So James and I are now going to go and watch this, the 70th minute of Alan J. Pakula and Robert Redford's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. We're going to come back and talk about it with you after the minute.
I'm Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, we're from the Washington Post.
Yes, I've read what you've written. I want to thank you. I've been a Republican all my life, but this goes beyond party politics.
Would you mind if we asked you a few questions?
No, come in. Would you like coffee?
Sure.
Well, what they've done is a threat to the Constitution. It goes against everything we stand for.
Could you be a little bit more specific than that?
I'm afraid your articles have just scratched the surface.
You don't mind if I just take a few notes, do you?
No.
How long have you worked at the committee?
Committee?
Yes, the committee to re-elect the president.
Oh, no, I don't work at the committee to re-elect the president. I work at Garfinkel's in the accounting department.
Miss Abbott?
Yes.
Judith Abbott?
There it is.
The funny thing about it is Blake, when you first approached me to be on this show, my first thought was, wow, what minute am I going to get? And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'd really like, I think it's around the 60th minute. I think that's when you first reached out to me. And I'm like, oh, I love that Ben Bradley scene, you know, where he's like, you know, you need some luck, get some, You know, and it's like, oh, that's such a great newsroom scene, you know, and I'd really love to talk about that. And then you told me my minute, and I'm like, oh, I get the Garfinkels. The one true red herring in the whole bunch. But I think that's actually a great opportunity to talk about a lot of different things, which is, you know, you certainly run into dead ends in any kind of in reporting any story, especially a story like this. Not to say I've ever investigated a story like this, but, you know, journalism is a great mix of like hope and despair. That's why we all have such great personal lives, right? But I tend to think of this scene like as a bookend to the scene earlier in the movie where Woodward, where Redford is talking to Ken Dahlberg.
Yes.
And, you know, he's tracked Dahlberg down. Dahlberg's called him back. You know, he's got him talking. And then, you know, Dahlberg says, you know, I don't know if I should be telling you this. And Redford closes his eyes. And any reporter anywhere knows that feeling. Where it's like, thank you, God. Like, please just talk. And you know, I mean, those are the magic words for any reporter.
I
don't know if I should be telling you.
I think I mentioned that in the episode that we did on that minute, which is when you hear, I don't know if I should be telling you this, even as an entertainment journalist, a tangential entertainment journalist as I am, hearing that in an interview for many of the, you know, interviews I've ever done, I don't know if I should be telling you this. It's like, oh, baby, this is going to be good. Whatever is about to be said now, this is going to be good.
Yeah, and you're so grateful to be alive at that very moment. And our scene now is the mirror image. It's of that, where it is the person who wants to talk to you could spend all day talking to you and in fact has nothing to tell you.
Yes.
That's going to be helpful. And so, you know, obviously Woodward and Bernstein, you know, in that position, the minute they realize they have the wrong woman and that their hope of finally finding someone, you know, close to the committee who can talk, it's all gone in an instant. And, you know, and suddenly their whole story is in tatters.
And it's so funny is that the lack of glamour of being on the phone in the office, on the floor of the Post, grinding for every second of that conversation, like, oh, for the love of God, please be this, or please come through on this. I really want to hear from this person. I really want to get that information. And then coming here to this beautiful staged moment, having tea, like having a tea on this very well ordained apartment. It's very beautiful and put together. And it feels like it is a complete throwback to another time, but almost like,
you know, genteel
and older money and having a tea. And, you know, this is a waspy Woodward's, like, he's been around people like this in his whole life. So he seems in his element. And I love just the posture of Hoffman. Like he's never been sitting on a velvet couch like this. He's like, he's just scribbling down the notes and letting Bob sort of lead the way, lead the dance, so to speak. And I just love that the whole posture of the scene, they see there's something out of place before you know something's out of place. Like everything's too easy. And it feels like a cheat. If this was the way they got the information, and this is so funny, is like, you don't, there's an implicit thing that's happening in your gut when you're watching this scene. Is like, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with this. This doesn't make sense. How is everything else been such a grind for every single detail? And someone is a chatty Cathy who wants to just have tea and a biscuit with you and give you everything. It seems so impossible and implausible.
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, everyone calls this movie a detective story, but it's like, it'd be like if you were watching a police thriller or detective story and you have the witness that nobody saw who comes in and claims they've seen everything that, you know, and then can't provide the right details about crime. And you know, and that is, I mean, the great thing about including that scene is showing, you know, I mean, Redford and the company, they were so committed to trying to portray the lack of glamour, as you put it, in the process. And the fact that you are going to have a lot of conversations that go nowhere. I mean, any reporter would ever tell you. I don't know what the percentage is of time you spend talking to people that never ends up in any story.
Yes.
Whether you're in politics, entertainment, government,
talking to contacts, checking in on folk, like maintaining relationships in the case that one day they're going to be able to give you one morsel of a nugget of that essential bit of information for a story.
Yeah. And you just, and you're literally looking for one thing. And like you said, that they thought they had found the key, you know, and of course, as we go on to see with Jane Alexander's character, you know, the truth is much more elusive, and that people with who actually know things are much harder to draw out.
Yes.
And so, you know, in this situation, yes, she was far too solicitous. The setting was wrong. I mean, this doesn't look like somebody who's been helping to cook the books, you know, for the Republican Party. And as it turns out, right, it's a complete dead end.
And I think you put it so perfectly. It does mirror the Dahlberg scene. We've been trained. And this is what's so great about this movie. We've been trained, like these guys are being trained, to smell that there's a rat here. But then also, you can't know. And this is what's so hard about this project for me, and why I get so thrilled when I talk to folk who don't have as close a relationship to it, is there's such a thrill for me every time I watch this movie when they get to the Alexander scene. And the bookkeeper scene and Hoffman there, because to even get in the door, it's a battle. It's a complete battleground. And so the moment that he's like battling in, you're like, once he's in and you can basically largely see her in silhouette in that door frame, it's like, oh God, she knows everything. Like there's just something about the setting, the lighting, her demeanor, and him being able to read that there's something so important that this, you know, crazy manic burn scene we've seen in the entire movie up until this point just completely settles into that, like Woodward, you know, very calm. I'm just going to extract this information. I'm going to speak far more slowly than you've heard me speak in the entire film. I think that's what I love about this scene, is the balance of movies and tonal shifts and sort of implicit ways that filmmakers want you to experience a story is just so critical to the alchemy of how a movie affects you. And I think that so many people, and why I'm excited to talk to you about this scene, and why I'm excited to talk about this scene just in general, is a lot of people would just dismiss this scene as like, oh, it's the red herring scene. And it's like, no, it's important, because when you hit that bookkeeper scene, which is only 6 minutes away, it's actually 5.5 minutes away. When you hit that scene, there's nothing more important. Like there's nothing more important in this whole story than that sequence and what blooms out of, you know, that sort of five, six minutes of the movie.
Well, what I love about it too, and you mentioned, you know, how Hoffman plays Bernstein, and they clearly have different approaches to their job, but through the course of the investigation, Bernstein becomes a little more like Woodward. And as you say, he becomes a little more measured. He's not so eager to cut corners. And just like write the story. He just, you know, he starts out as a guy who seems to have it all figured out already. He just wants to write the story he has in his head. And Woodward's like, no, you know, we don't have it. But there's a scene, and I can't remember, it's close to this, where they're back in the McDonald's, and suddenly it's Woodward who's saying, we've got it, let's go. And it's Bernstein saying, no, we need something else. We need one more. You know, what Bernstein was able to do in this movie is you see that he's a charmer. You know, he's got people skills in a way that Woodward doesn't, who's more of a blunt instrument. And those people skills are the things that I think that in the Jane Alexander scene, he's got the emotional intelligence, at least the way the movie portrays him, in a way that Woodward is, you know, Woodward comes off in the movie, I think, you know, as he is just someone who just will just work, try to outwork the story, ask as many questions as he can, knock on 10,000 doors, where Bernstein is a little more, you know, he's a little more of a work smart guy than a work hard guy. And I think that really pays off later, you know, in that bookkeeper scene.
And the people skills are important as well, right? So it's like he's completely, in the scene we're talking about, he's completely out of his element, because it doesn't feel natural. It feels very staged, and it's very, and you know, that it's
I think I have to recall back to like grandmother's houses where you special biscuits and special cutlery and special plates are only brought out for special guests, not for just grandkids or the immediate family. It's like extended relatives come out and special cutlery comes out and special plates come out and all those sorts of things. You know, again, a very sort of throwback thing, but just simply asking for a cigarette, just bumming a cigarette is such a Bernstein in. It's such a I just need to bum a cigarette, or I just need to, you know, sort of cheekily have a coffee and he's smart enough to know
we have an ally in the sister.
Yes.
So it's like, I have an ally in the house. So if I don't play my cards right, I don't piss anybody off, I can get something out of this.
And also the guy who bums a cigarette and the guy who flubs a coffee at 9 p.m. at night is a guy who also maybe doesn't have the best memory, even though he is whip smart and he does have a great memory. It's like, my memory is just shot. So I just need to, and just those little touches. Whereas here, he's just sort of authentic. There's a great comparison with him. He's just authentic. He's like, I'm going to take notes because this person just wants to talk to Bob. And that's the great thing I think about Redford's Woodward is he feels more like a sponge, a sort of a charming sponge. Like people talk at him and he will just consume it all. And it's just these little baby kind of gentle prods and prompts and people who kind of, he just puts himself in the position for people to talk at him and around him. And he gets lots of information from just being able to ask the right question without being sort of tenacious like Bernstein can be. But I think that, yeah, this, the whole interplay of these guys and how they, you know, I don't know about you, James, but even in like crummy jobs I've worked, there is something cool when you work with people, you're like, they do something really good that you just haven't got in your tool shed yet, or your toolbox rather. And you're like, I'm going to steal that. That's great. Like the way that person does that. And I think that there's something underappreciated, not in a malicious way of like, I'm going to steal that person's story, I'm going to steal it, but just like the way that some people approach things or think about things or tackle a problem. You're like, that's really good. If I could have that in my arsenal to draw on that eventually, it's only going to benefit me in a future story.
Well, in the key scene, I mean, in terms of their relationship, right, and I'm sure you talked about this, but is the scene earlier in the movie where Bernstein starts rewriting Woodward.
Yes.
Where he's taking his story, rewriting it. And that is the critical scene because a lot of reporters in that situation would get pissed off.
Yes.
And be like, hey, it's my story. I'm going to write it my way, butt out, you know. And that was the critical where you know, Woodward sublimates his ego and recognizes the fact that Bernstein can bring something to the table, that he is a more polished writer.
Yes.
Maybe he can organize the material in a more effective way. And that builds the bridge that's what leads into their productive relationship, recognizing that they can complement each other.
I mentioned it on another podcast. I actually read it aloud, but my friend of the show, Sean Burns, who's a terrific Bostonian film critic, shouted this out on Twitter. Carl Bernstein recently wrote a really great piece for CNN, a political piece, and it's got a 109-word lead. And Sean was like, look at Bernstein still being a total boss, writing 109-word flaming leads to stories, as he was doing during Watergate, you know, maybe not penetrating as much because of the dilution of media, as you talked about, as far as, you know, different outlets and different agendas and just in general, like different levels of consumption. The man's still a boss, still a florid, terrific writer, and still doing terrific writing work to this day. So,
You don't do this job for the money. You don't do the job for the for the love. So, you know, you got to get your satisfaction somewhere. And if that comes from, you know, writing a great lead or writing the hell out of a story, well, that's, you know, good for you because you need to get something. You need to get something out of it, man.
There's got to be some self-satisfaction there.
There's got to be a reason to get out of bed in the morning.
That's it.
You know, one of the other interesting things about this scene too, Blake, is I feel like it really is a sort of a harbinger of the disinformation.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
The conspiracy theories that dominate so much of our media world now, where it's like, you know, where she's obviously living in a different reality.
Yes.
Than they are, you know, and she thinks they finally come to her door to write about the conspiracy that she lives in her own life, you know, and that gets me thinking about, you know, the QAnon people. Oh. And all the different conspiracy theories that we see on the web, and, you know, people who just, again, like, we're in a position now without the kind of institutional media culture that we used to have, where, you know, 1,000 conspiracy theories bloom. And this is, I think this is a precursor to that.
I think you're so right. And it's conspiracies have gone mainstream, and it seems like, at different points in history, it simmered up, but the media landscape has been able to sort of regulate it to a certain extent. But, you know, the challenge is, and this is what sucks, is the challenge is that just the media landscape at the moment, you have, and the big one is Epstein, and you have the right. Epstein, and everything that's happening with Epstein, where I'm sure you would have seen it because you're an online, you as an individual are an online entity. You see things simmering up, you see these weird things, you see them being reported on these like maverick outlets, and they're saying all this stuff, and you're like, you know what? This isn't quite as mad as QAnon. Some of this might actually have legs. Some of it seems to be dodgy. Some of it actually has evidence that, you know, or tendrils of something that can be investigated. And then later on, sometimes a decade later, you see that it manifests in the mainstream media. And I think that there's like, not everything is an Epstein story, but I think what's been challenging is that some of them have bloomed out of like being on these maverick weird sites, and then they penetrate the mainstream, and people realize actually this was a story. This was something that the media, for whatever reason, didn't want to touch. And then why didn't they want to touch it? It's one of those, you know, everything out of Watergate, and JFK did it as well. It's like that distrust and that the institutional distrust that started out with politics at this time, then sort of bloomed into let's not trust journalistic institutions because right. Media is manipulative. So in this, it's a very good reflex to be cynical and questionable of any kind of political entity, especially, you know, if you're in a broadly democratic society, it's good to question politics and power and money and entanglement. It's a good reflex to have. But you know, as you talked about with something that Trump did successfully, he weaponized the concept of him being the story and him being the source. And if you weren't getting it from the source, it was a lie.
The White House has worked diligently to set itself up as an information source. And it, you know, if you're not believing what they're telling you, it's the news media that's getting it wrong, not them. And don't trust them. Don't trust what they say. Only trust what we say. And, you know, the fact that there has been such an erosion of trust in the media, it's perfect for an environment like this. You can exploit that environment. And so, I mean, I've been in situations where I've had to disabuse my own daughter of conspiracy theories. She's 15. You know, she's on the web. She's asking me questions about Barack Obama and Jeffrey Epstein and you know, and just stuff, you know, she and her friends see on YouTube or on, you know, on Instagram. And we have, you know, because there's 1,000 outlets now and 1,000 channels, and because the media is so splintered, there is no gate function. And you can argue whether that's good or not. You know, in the Watergate days, we had Walter Cronkite. We had, you know, we had the three networks and the nightly news and a press, an all-white male press, mainly, that function as the people who decided what to tell you and what not to tell you. And there's plenty of stuff they covered up and didn't tell you. It's just, you know, what we have now is the Wild West.
But you can get stuck. You can get stuck in a rabbit hole. Like, there are folks who like go down YouTube documentary rabbit holes and things that are just produced from a formal and technical level that feel like that's the great manipulation of the documentary form, right? Like, if you say things in a certain way and you do things in a certain way, you can basically tell people anything, and it's really powerful and affecting and can influence them and change their mind about something or really cement in an idea. And it is all horseshit. It's all just, none of it makes sense. None of it's based on any kind of fact, or they choose very carefully when to have key facts and then have things that are posing as facts that are next to those things, adjacent to them, and edit them together seamlessly. And then those things tend to make sense for some folk. And I think there's a real sort of collective mode that everyone has to operate with any of those YouTube documentaries that I just don't think a lot of young kids have been trained with yet, which is like, documentary cinema is like a great tool, is the greatest tool for propaganda in the world. Like, cinema is just in general the greatest tool for propaganda in the world. So like, when people are doing these things, you've got to ask, like, who is the person? Who is the outlet? What are they trying to do? Maybe who's funding it? Like, and what's their agenda? Like, what's the rest of their channel saying? You know, maybe just ask a couple of those key questions. And if you start to see some gaps, then maybe how verifiable and accurate and true what these folk are saying on those YouTube. I can't imagine it. You're doing God's work, as far as I'm concerned, dissuading people to do that. I'm doing it as an uncle with, you know, 10 and 12 year olds when they want to learn about a topic. I'm like, all right, go listen to this podcast. Go watch this documentary, listen, go to this outlet, maybe read this book. That's what you need to do. That's where you need to start. They're a good starting point for things you need to learn. Don't listen to this person. Don't listen to that. Don't watch this news outlet. This is not where you need to get this from. Go to this other more viable outlet. Don't watch YouTube documentaries. Go to Netflix at least. At least what
yeah, well, you know, and you do. You have to be a more active consumer of the news, and you have to almost think about it as evaluating products, you know, yes, for reliability, and who can you trust and who can't you trust. And in a way, I mean, I think that's preferable to everybody being a passive consumer and just accepting whatever the institutional take is, but it requires more effort. You do have to do, you know, you have to find out ways to find accurate information. And it's harder. I mean, there's so much noise. Yeah. And I think what we're seeing with the COVID pandemic is a real struggle at times for science, you know, a set of what we consider to be a set of scientific principles, yes, yielding at times to opinion and political passion. And, you know, we can't be in a position where we consider objective scientific facts a matter of opinion. And,
I just think also what is crazy, and this is the whole how things are consumed. The other day, I think, I can't remember which state it was in the United States, whether it was Florida or something, hit one of the largest instances of new cases in any part of the world in a single day. And on the same day, and this is like my curated news feed of like the publications that I subscribe to or trust, and, you know, following different individuals such as yourself or, you know, reporters that I trust. And in that same feed on that same day, as they were talking about that spike, New Zealand announced that there were no instances of COVID-19 in the country. Like, in the whole North and South Island, they'd squashed it. And
in Germany, I think Germany has under 1,000.
Yeah, it's some crazy. And in Australia, I think in Australia at the moment, we've got more active because of a recent couple of spikes in Victoria, one of our southern states. But in New Zealand, even Australia, looking over New Zealand, New Zealand have full stadiums. They love rugby in New Zealand, like it's their bread and butter. And like, there's full rugby stadiums of video of all these folk like in a stadium. There's no COVID restrictions. And they're all just like people arm in arm watching rugby. And like, you do everything you can to like not cry. Like the other day I went to a cinema for the first time in however many months, and I sat with like two of my dearest friends and we were watching some classic movies together. We watched Predator, we watched Jaws, we watched 2001 A Space Odyssey. It was a little repertory theater.
Oh, fantastic.
Watched them all on the big screen together. And like you have to do everything, but like when, you know, when Arnold Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers' arms clasp in Predator and you see their bicep squeeze and the crowd cheered, I was like, I had to not cry because it was like, oh, community, people, like, this is...
That's this not is commercial like, to Action Jackson.
Look, Carl, the Carl Weathers canon is important, is an important discussion, but not...
Maybe you should do Action Jackson minute by minute. That should be your next project.
Look... It's certainly the first time it's been recommended and actually it might make a fascinating miniseries because I love me some Carl Weathers, man. Love me some.
Well, yeah, I mean, taking apart an 80s film, just given the very specific the very specific nature of 80s films, I think would be a valuable exercise.
That's at some
point. All the excess and...
The excess, the funding, like looking at... I love especially 80s action films... have a complete beautiful dialogue with one another internationally. You like watch these great blaxploitation movies and you see Bond try and make a blaxploitation Bond and they're communicating with space films because there's obviously the omnipresence of the space opera in Star Wars. So it's like people are trying to make space action. It's a fun genre. It's a fun one. That might be a mini series somewhere down the track. The fun dialogue between blaxploitation and action cinema just in general around the world because there's some really good ones. But yeah, look, you know, that I think that that's what's so crazy to me is that I think what universally we've been told in films or what universally we've hoped the presumption that we've had as, you know, just citizens of the world is that when there is something that is universally verifiable that has an impact on people, that people can accept that, okay, we're going to have restrictions, we're going to restrict it, and you see other countries that like eradicate it or basically limit it to the most minor of number of people and then they can continue on with their society. And even in Australia recently, the recent surges and spikes are just people being irresponsible. There was like one guy, one security guard at a nightclub in Victoria, like shagged like 30 people and gave like 100 people this goddamn virus. And it's like, man, put it away. Like just...
There's your 80s movie.
Talk about Action Jackson. We brought it right back around. But you know, like the war on facts in a political context, there's never been a better topic to like have scientific verifiable facts where the bottom line is death, is people dying.
But we see that. We see the roots of all of it in all the presidents and then, where, you know, they begin to attack the Post. They attack the Post credibility. They suggest Ben Bradley has an agenda. I mean, nothing in Trump's playbook is new.
No.
I mean, this has been going on for a long time. And it was, the idea is to...
Dave Chappelle calls it poor white people's greatest hits, is which I find very...
Well, you destroy the messenger's credibility. I mean, that's the oldest trick in the book, right? So, so much was planted, the seeds of that, you know. What I find fascinating is that one of the things that led to Nixon's resignation was that final tape where, you know, people, the American public got to see the real Nixon, basically. They heard the profanity and they heard, you know, and again, we were talking about common standards of behavior. He had violated some sort of ideal that we hold for presidents, right? And Trump, you know, one of the interesting things about him is that he was elected as a known commodity. I mean, you know, they knew who Donald Trump was for 30 years. And even the stuff that that broke over the course of the campaign, culminating in the Access Hollywood tape. I mean, it shows you how we have grown to accommodate huge, you know, variations in behavior for our presidents. And so, you know, where the American public, or one portion of the American public, was shocked to find Nixon to be so So venal.
Yes.
Trump was elected on the very premise of that, of being a person. You know, I mean, it was like, yeah, we know what we're getting. We don't care.
I think it was one thing that was actually talked about in another, perhaps another episode, which is just the concept that someone at some point who received that Access Hollywood tape thought, I have this. This is my Watergate.
This is the thing that's going to bring it down.
This is my Watergate. And look at what, like, I think we could probably both agree. It's like, there does not seem to be, despite now we're seeing the erosion, as you put it, of his base, but there has not yet been a smoking gun in this entire presidency that seems to be able to bring him down, or even have the Republicans come around on him. Because that's the other thing, you know. I think the other challenge is the Republican Party, the Republican identity has become so intrinsically Trumpian that it's like it doesn't seem possible that there's other good, when there absolutely plausibly has to be, just by definition, there has to be other good people that are more like a classical sort of conservative candidate that are in the party in the wings going, this guy's unacceptable. Can't we do something? can't we do something?
Well, you know, there was a belief at some point during the Mueller investigation that that might happen, or impeachment, where Republicans, you know, might rise up and say, hey, you know, this is our opportunity. But, you know, the truth of the matter is as long as he's popular with the party, and he's tremendously popular among Republicans still, although, as I said, that's beginning to wane, it's too much of a risk to criticize the president. And in fact, I don't know when this is going to air, but Jeff Sessions, the former attorney general, lost a primary in Alabama last night. He was trying to get his old Senate seat back.
Yes.
And he couldn't even make it. He couldn't even make it to the general election because he was viewed as being insufficiently supportive of Trump. And so, you know, if that's going to be the environment in the party, it's going to be very difficult for anyone to take him on. Now, that being said, politics is a blood sport, and if we go into September, October, he's down 10. And then and of course, you know, you will see Republicans starting to distance themselves, trying to run races that don't mention him, or say Republicans saying they don't agree with everything he does. And if he loses in November, you'll see the party, we don't know what's going to happen, but it'll split along lines of people who want to go backwards, forwards, carry on Trump's policies, some who don't. But there will be a reckoning of some kind.
It's going to be unfathomable. I can't imagine what that's going to be like if they do. I mean, I can't imagine what it's going to be like to have another, to know that for four more years, Donald Trump is going to be the president of the United States, nor can I imagine what it's going to be like for the Republican Party and the base and the people who ultimately supported him to try and find relevance again. Like how do you find relevance when you become a splinter cell of, like, you know, sort of centrist, as you said, and then Trumpian, and then far right. Like, far.
Well, you know, we could ask that question in 76.
Yeah.
When Ford lost to Carter, and the Republican brand was completely destroyed.
Yes.
And Reagan was elected 4 years later. So politics are mercurial, and, you know, all it takes is the right person to come along and capture the public's imagination. And suddenly you go from, I mean, I'll tell you a story, Blake, that I was sent to Wisconsin very late in the 2016 campaign to write basically a postmortem for the Republican Party. You know, the idea was that Hillary Clinton was going to win, Trump was going to lose. You know, Trump had made all these outrageous statements in the course of his campaign, and now the Republican Party was going to have to pick up the pieces, and how were they going to do that? And then we all know that that story never got written because Trump won, and then suddenly it was like, how did the Democrats pick up the pieces, because they just lost to Donald Trump? And so, I mean, that is one of the, for me, I think one of the very interesting things about politics is that it, you know, nothing lasts forever. And, you know, politicians come along and they look like they're going to have they're going to cast a gigantic shadow for years. And then, you know, there's the new flavor of the month comes along and everything is upended. You know, we were talking in 2016, because when it looked like Clinton was going to win, the country is changing demographically, so will Republicans ever be relevant? And then a Republican wins by just, you know, hitting just the right notes and the right voters and building a coalition that was in the face of those changes. But, you know, this is a long way of saying that we don't know, you know, if Biden were to win in November, who's to say a Republican doesn't win 4 years from now?
As long as it's not him.
I wouldn't rule that out either. I wouldn't rule out him running again either. So it's like,
clarify that for me. If he does get, if he loses an election, he can go again, but he can only go for 4 years, a single term presidency.
That's right. He can.
Has that ever happened?
Yeah, Grover Cleveland did it.
Wow.
You remember Grover Cleveland, don't you?
No. Not at all.
19th century. He ran, he won a first term, lost, and then ran again. He's the only president to ever serve non-consecutive terms. Yeah. So it can be done. And we see governors do it in America. They'll sometimes come back and have a second act. Usually when you lose in presidential politics, you're finished.
Yes.
And, you know, the party moves on, and they don't want to relitigate the past. So, but with Trump, all things are possible.
All things. There's an amazing commencement address from JFK that I think I've been thinking of just as we've been talking this whole time, and I won't read the whole address, and it might introduce the show, but that concept of we all breathe the same air, we all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. That those three things have, like, it feels like in the time of COVID-19, mortality is like, who cares? It's like, and we're all mortal, but who gives a shit? It's like we're all young, we're not old, who cares? It's just old people and immunocompromised, and like, we all cherish our children's future, you know, unless our children are young and we're old and they don't care about what we're doing, because we don't care about what their future, and we all breathe the same air. Like, even breathing the same air, you know, people can't wear a mask. It's because it's infringing on their freedoms. And in Australia, you know, we haven't had to go to that level of lockdown in my state just yet. It's definitely not out of the question. But I just also think that, man, if we have to, I'm interested to see, because I don't think we're above it by any stretch of the imagination. I'm interested to see those people who just flat out refuse to put on a mask and flat out refuse to think about the community that surrounds them. And that's part of what it is. Like, this whole community transmission is the challenge. It's not about you not necessarily being able to cope with it or being healthy enough to battle through it. It's about who you know and who you love and what compromising health situation they may have. It's really, really, really interesting.
Well, our friend, the Garfinkel's woman in our scene, is the kind of person who wouldn't wear a mask.
Oh, 100%.
And would not believe the virus could harm her.
She wouldn't hang around in any circles that would get the virus either.
No, she'd be, her tea set gives that away, as I said. And especially in the DC of 1974, or 72, I guess, was when the movie takes place, but which was a very divided, polarized.
Yeah, you only have to start reading Fear and Loathing in the campaign trail, be a chapter in, and the portrait of Washington D.C. as painted by Hunter S. Thompson in his gonzo journalistic stylings reads like it's the city in Escape from New York is basically what Washington D.C. reads like in 1972.
You know, and if you like indulge me for a second, one of the things that really also fascinates me about this movie is I really am interested in films that are made very close to an event in history that they're trying to portray.
Yes.
And even like, you know, like going back to films like Casablanca or even, you know, a war film like 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, it was fascinating to think of Hollywood making movies about World War II when they didn't know the outcome.
Yes.
No, they didn't know if the Nazis were going to take over the world. They didn't know if the American, you know, if the United States was going to be overcome or Britain or, and still trying to provide a product in that environment. And one of the fascinating things about to be
or not to be with Jack Benny, the comedy is one of the greatest comedies.
Comedy in the middle of a world war.
In the middle of the war, that is broadly about an egomaniac who's, you know, ultimately so many Hitler allusions in the film that aren't explicit but are very, very defined. And it's like, this is a guy making a comedy about World War II. In World War II. Finding a way to make it about this. Incredible.
And so, you know, we know that that Redford pushed Woodward Bernstein to develop their book and then develop the book, you know, around the idea of their reporting. And this all took place 73. The book finally came out in 74, in the summer of 74. And by that time, the film was already, cranking up. William Goldman was writing the screenplay. And, you know, the amazing thing about it, Blake, is Nixon had not yet resigned.
Nope.
Right? So, and obviously...
didn't quite have their ending.
Yeah, right? They didn't have their ending.
No.
And it's a very different movie if Nixon doesn't quit. And
the different United States of America.
Right? You need that. You need that final sentence. And, you know, whenever you do your final minute, like, because I've had people who've seen this movie and have complained because they feel like the drama is in the second half of the Watergate story, not in the first half of the Watergate story. Like, why don't we see why don't we see Nixon yelling at the JFK painting? No.
That's for Oliver Stone and no one else, James.
And no one else. So, you know, the idea that Redford and Pakula, they went forward with this project without even knowing the ultimate fate of Richard Nixon is fascinating to me. And they still felt like the story was powerful enough to tell, and they didn't need it. But I think as it turns out, historically, they did need it, because you need it, you know, for all the door knocking that we're talking about, you needed to know that pays off in something bigger than getting a few aides indicted,
yes,
right? Or finding, you know, some intelligence gathering scheme going on the part of the Republicans. You need to know that there was for something involving the Republic. That's why you have that great Ben Bradley speech at the end to remind you of the stakes.
You're contextualizing it from a political standpoint, but also I think that that's one of the vacancies that I see in sort of corporate malfeasance, where you see that a CEO resigns and they leave and you go, maybe it's because I've watched all the President's Men an incalculable amount of times at this point, uncountable, incalculable. It's like not a single leader at the top is completely complicit for all the bad things. There is a culture that happens. And what's so wonderful about Watergate is in the following the money, these guys meticulously track the key players and key decision makers that manifested that ultimate culture within the White House, within the Republican Party in that time, at that moment. And then they are excised. So in some ways it's liberating for the Republican Party because all of those people get taken out of it. I feel like every knocked on door, every individual that they're running up to, and then ultimately Nixon himself, it's a thrilling exercise to go through. And I think sometimes, you know, some people have had that criticism as well. It's like, it would be great to see Nixon. It's like, no, sometimes history is more powerful than the ending of a movie. Like if you can just pave the way for history to bookend the film, I think that the power is all there. Like it leaves you with a feeling that's so hard to recreate.
And the brilliance of the movie are the scenes where, you know, Woodward's typing away while everyone else is watching television, while other events are happening, while Nixon's being renominated, you know, and they show something as pedestrian as the Washington Post being delivered to the White House. I mean, that's all they have to do.
Yes.
is to say, look, you know, this little, I mean, that's why I'm in journalism, right? I mean, this entity being delivered to your front door is going to bring down this president. And we all know it. And that's the great thing in watching it, is that something that looks very humble, the thing that's delivered to your doorstep in the morning, is actually, you know, this tremendous defender of American values. And I mean, in a way, it makes All the President's Men one of the most patriotic movies in film history, because it is about upholding the Constitution, the First Amendment, you know, separation of powers, everything that we say we believe in about this country. And, you know, and it's put to the test, and we survive, right? And you compare it with something, let's just say, like The Big Short, which is a movie I really enjoyed.
Yes.
And to your point, where, yeah, hey, these guys are the smartest. They figured out this, you know, they figured out the economy was going to collapse, and, you know, these mortgage-backed securities were fraudulent. But CEOs didn't go to jail. There's no, you know, there's no final scene where you see anybody paying a price.
Yeah, Adam McKay uses the technique of All the President's Men on the inverse, which is that no one went to jail, and also the very thing that these guys invented that caused this entire crisis, they're already kind of half dabbling at doing again, and none of the regulations that should have completely ironed this out ran the table. It's now here we go. Pay it off. And it's and even as recent, you know, it was a really good John Stewart interview actually on Joe Rogan, where he talked about, it's like, he's like, when I was, John Stewart's talking about when he was on his show and he was talking to some of the chief economists at the time going, okay, so you're paying the banks to keep these mortgages, right? And they're like, yes. And like, he goes, why wouldn't you, and surely it would cost less money, go see all the bad mortgages that are out there and just pay them off. Because then you're basically paying off all the bad mortgages, so they're only good mortgages, and then that saves the economy. Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you do that? And they're like, oh, we can't do that. And I laughed out loud, because Joe Rogan goes, no, that makes too much sense. Why would they do that? And that's exactly what I'm like, oh, well, doesn't that make sense? Like, you just pay off all the bad mortgages. There are no bad mortgages. And then the other people, you help them if they've lost their jobs or whatever. You do that for a tactical amount of time. And then there's a bit of restoration. You punish the people that got it there. You re-engineer what they're doing. I don't disagree with you that the big short also made hot on the heels of its topic. Doesn't give us any of the satisfaction. And I think Adam McKay is giving you a massive, you know, that's him flexing his muscles there and giving you a warning. Cause I feel like
he wants you to walk away mad, not satisfied.
Yes. Yes. He wants to say that change hasn't happened. See all the work these guys did to show how stupid everyone was, and to call out that this was bad. They were right. You know, but unfortunately, it's like that middle scene with Bradley, where they said they nominate J. Edgar Hoover for the FBI director for life, and he says, "Tell Brent Bradley, fuck you." Sometimes it's fine to be right, but you know, but it probably wasn't best for the country that I was right, and so I think that's McKay is like giving us that level of dissatisfaction at the end of The Big Short, because it's just insane.
And so somebody at some point, some movie maker is going to try to get this era down on some level. I'm not sure what form that would ever take, but this has been so calamitous and tumultuous for 4 years that it's going to be represented in cinema. I'm interested to see how you get something, you know, when we're living in such vivid detail, every minute, as you say, with, you know, Trump being the central figure in our lives, central figure in the media's lives. How do you dramatize something that you feel like has already been played out on screens every day for 4 years?
Well, I hope that there's a, Robert Redford that's got the clout to push it. And I hope that there's, I think there's some exceptionally talented Alan Pakula-esque workman-like great actors, directors, and maybe there's a Gordy Willis of our generation that can be out there from the darkness that can kind of make it happen. I don't know. I don't envy the task, but I think they've got to, I think if anything, this movie is about starting small and pushing the people who've done the work. And the challenge is, you know, I think when it's all over, what's going to be even more interesting if we see a text and can sort of see all the earmarks of something like an All the President's Men and a prestige something that doesn't feel like a Lifetime movie. Because the challenge is, the knife's edge is, am I a shitty Lifetime movie or am I All the President's Men, The Social Network, The Big Short, you know, Casablanca? Because the knife's edge is treacherous. You can fall into Lifetime movie very easily.
Well, that's where Eric Roberts plays Trump.
Oh, God. There's already that Brendan Gleeson Trump movie that's coming, which looks bad. TV show. There's something. And look, we're never going to top Eric Roberts playing Trump in this one. So, James Oliphant, look, mate, it's an absolute pleasure talking to you. I'm so glad that we got to hook up. And this has been such a fun conversation. I thank you for what you're doing. I'm looking forward to reading your continued coverage of everything that's unfolding. And as we ramp up towards November, I'd love to have you on again. I'll find you another newsroom minute that'll make you feel like it's in there. But I feel like we've got so much more to say. But I just cannot top the pinnacle of Eric Roberts as Trump in my mind. It's going to distract me for the rest of the day. Thank you so much for being a part of the show.
It's been great, Blake. Thanks so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, James Oliphant. What a absolute gentleman. What a great journalistic mind. What a great political mind. And now I'm so glad to say is absolutely and positively a friend of the show. We're going to have him back on. At James Oliphant is where you can find him on Twitter. James, obviously the normal spelling, but O-L-I-P-H-A-N-T is where you can sort of jump off onto Reuters and all of his other stuff. It was a real pleasure to talk to him. I can't wait to talk to him again. If you can, please subscribe, rate, review the show. It's a huge help if you can do that. Just anything you can do like that and sharing it around to folks. And if you've been a listener for a long time or you're a new listener and you dig it, share it around the place, but rate and review it if you can. It is a monstrous help to us on the show. It attracts more attention to the show for folks who are out there who may be interested in it and who may be following other shows that are like ours. That would be a massive help. Thank you so much. Guys, I'm Blake Howard. It's One Blake Minute on Twitter, at ATPM Pod on Twitter for the show. OneHeatMinute.com is where you can find everything else that we're doing. And if you do have a little bit of extra scratch right now during COVID, we would love and appreciate a donation. You can find the links in the description of this show on whatever podcast app you're using. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another great episode this week. Great lineup this week. One of our best ever. James, just another addition to it. And tomorrow, another great episode. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save.